Can you see me?
I am. Mic test. There you go. Yeah. So thank you for this opportunity to stand before you and to share my story. And most especially, I want to thank this congregation for your support, your love, and encouragement all the 4 years now that I've been in the Philippines. And later on, and second half of what I'm sharing with you this morning will be about the mission, the work that I do in partnership with Mountain View Christian Fellowship, in partnership with you all. So as Pastor Vigan mentioned, he had asked me, I was ready to preach a sermon, but he thought that it's probably important that I would share my story this morning. Maybe some of you have a little bit of an idea of what my testimony is all about. And maybe this is something to refresh your memory. But I hope that my story will encourage you, especially those of you who are either sitting on the fence and wanting to know whether to follow Jesus or not, and those who are just curious about who this Jesus that I have come, or we have come to worship and honor and serve. So exactly 5 years ago today, literally today, I went to Tacloban City. This is basically epicenter, or the city that was hardest hit by this typhoon, Super Typhoon Haiyan. And if you remember, that happened in November 13 of 2013. And so I went there. I committed to spend 3 weeks helping friends who were ministering to the survivor of that typhoon. And thousands of people died, and hundreds more perished and did not survive the fury of that super typhoon. And the mammoth storm has left catastrophic damage to the Philippines. More than 14 million, imagine 14 million people have been affected by that typhoon in the Philippines. And Tacloban City, where I went and was the hardest hit, looked completely devastated. It was as if a giant hand came down from the sky and just crushed it. You have seen, probably some of you have seen coconut trees. They're one of the most sturdiest trees there is in my country. But it is so surreal to see, you know, all these palm trees and these coconut trees just flatten on the hilltops. Because of the force of the storm. So what's even sad for me personally was that most of those who have been affected by this typhoon all over the Philippines, not just in that area, at that city I went, they were mostly the marginalized, the poor people. So I remembered I went to this place that as far as the van can take us, because the roads were all destroyed, and I went there, brought some money that I have raised from here and also my personal money. And on the way back, when we have organized this community and we decided that instead of just giving them some food, I decided I want to give them a boat so that they can use a rotation and gives them something that's more sustainable than just giving them, you know, a food to eat. So on the way back, we were looking for this man who was going to build the boat. And you know, they were highly in demand at that time, but we had God's favor because that man, you know, agreed to build our boat. So we were looking for this man. So we stopped in one of these towns on the way back, and I remembered seeing this swarm of kids and old people, okay? These are really seniors now, and coming towards us with tin cans, plates, and some of them half naked, and they're just looking for food. They were hungry, because then we found out that since that November, they only have received two drops, you know, from helicopters, two helps anyway. So they were hungry. There's no food. And it was so heartbreaking for me, because when we asked them where their parents are, they just basically, you know, as Filipinos would do, point, that's where my parents are, it's buried there. They told us story after story. And it was that time that maybe there was a turning point for me, because just listening to that, I'm not a crying guy, I'm an emotional person because I'm a musician, but I shed some tears that just couldn't help just looking at, you know, these children especially and those older people. And that time, that was, and then I sensed just a deep desire. At that time, I didn't know whether that was a call for me, but a deep desire for me to come back to the Philippines and work, especially with the poor. So I never predicted that 10 months after that, I would find myself, or I would give up my comfortable life in Canada and move back to my home country to serve the poor. A lot of people, especially my family, were dumbfounded, and maybe some of you are also like wondering how anyone could trade a life in Canada for a life in the Philippines, living among the poor in the slums of Davao. That's where I am right now. And the answer is the story of God's extravagant grace and His plan for my life. I grew up in a big family, 10 children. I am the 8th in the family, and during my time, my parents were busy in public service, running a bakery and fast food business and working so hard to provide for a huge family. And they worked so hard so that we could go to reputable schools, good schools outside of the cities. Outside of my home city. And however, a lot of my older brothers who have now gone to Manila, to Cebu, to go to these private universities, took that for granted and squandered that opportunity and wasted it and ended up getting their girlfriends pregnant, and then they had to marry. And that really devastated my parents and brought a lot of heartache to my parents and eventually drained them financially. And because of that, I remember telling myself, I was at 9 at that time, that I would never be like them when I grow up. And because of that sheer determination, my childhood then was filled with dreams and ambitions, and I was so driven to succeed in life. And my entire family was born into a Catholic faith. Although not particularly religious, my parents occasionally took my siblings and I to church, but we never really talked about God at home. And I have never heard the gospel preached growing up. My parents sort of schooled my siblings and I in Catholic religion only in service for tradition. God has no living presence in our family. We did not say grace before we ate or we eat meals. We did not say prayers before bedtime. We did say the rosary a lot of time or from time to time, but we did not read the Bible. In fact, at that time, it was a no-no for us to even touch a Bible because the Catholic Church would perceive or considers it a sin if a Bible is being held, and especially those who are not Catholic going even to church and holding a Bible. So we never had that. I witnessed myself a private Catholic school burned some Bibles, and I had no understanding what that is. And, you know, growing up, and that was what the message we have received, it was not as devastating as I thought, you know, as it is now for me to see that. But like I said, we prayed the rosary from time to time, but we did not, we did not read the Bible at home or discuss morality in terms of God's nature or His will. And going to church was more of a ritual for us as a family, especially when we were in need, to gain the favor of God rather than to worship Him. So church was an option for us, for all of us. We were never pressured to go to school, to church. We were not even encouraged to go to church. But in my senior year in high school, I started going to Catholic masses regularly, sometimes 3 times a week, because I needed God to help me with the very difficult university entrance exam. You can appreciate this because in the Philippines, there's a lot. Like, I mean, we're how many millions? Now we are going to 107. But even my time, maybe we were under 70 million. And so the universities, especially private universities, can only accommodate a certain number of students every beginning of a school year. So I needed to pass that entrance exam so that I could go into this semi-American private school. So I would say the rosary most days to gain Mother Mary's favor. And there's one time where I was kneeling and walking towards the altar, just to tell God that, this is so important for me, so you better really, help me out with my exam. And in spite of that, in God's sovereignty, I passed the entrance exam with flying colors and got to attend this private school with a scholarship and to pursue a degree in accounting. From then on, my life was occupied by college and extracurricular activities in school. And during those days, I held religion firmly at arm's length. I would only go to God when I was in trouble or when I needed something that no one else can do. And my life was empty, you know, and meaningless. Though I was somewhat popular in school, I was lonely inside. I had a girlfriend, I joined a fraternity, and I was partying practically every weekend and having a good time, eventually and unknowingly following my brother's footsteps. But none of those filled the void inside. I felt so insecure inside, and I was looking for man's affirmation and approval and always wanting to belong. And contrary to public opinion, I may appear like very confident, you know, to my classmates and peers, but really inside I was so insecure, and I always think that I am like a nobody and not capable of doing some stuff. So that was very hard for me growing up, and yet with the pressure for me to succeed, especially the pressure coming from my family. So because of that, I was drinking and taking drugs to numb the haunting emptiness of a purposeless life. I became an alcoholic at 18, and I had an overdose at age 20, and I became suicidal after that. My life at this time was spiraling out of control. I called on to God for help, but he never appeared to me in a way I would understand. While I lay drunk in the canal or when I was fighting for my life at the hospital when I had an overdose. And yet, looking back on my life, I see that Christ was beckoning me at every turn. When I was a child, he was there in the kindness of my nanny, who was a Christian, and how she had modeled a godly life. I remember she was in her room. We used to call her She's Crazy because she would always read her Bible and she would sing. And she was always out of tune, but she sang nevertheless. But that was amazing for me to see. I did not understand why. We thought that she was really crazy because we never really grew up that way. Or that was not something that we do in church. But, you know, later on when Habib became a Christian she went to an Alliance church, and she was no longer working for us. I saw her when I shared my testimony that Sunday, and she was crying. She said, "I remembered those times that I prayed for you and your family. I still pray that you guys will come to the saving knowledge of the Lord Jesus Christ. And I know that I am here today because of her prayer." And she's probably the first one that I know that had prayed for me, okay? So when she was there, when I was a troubled young man contemplating suicide, God was in the voice of my cousin who told me about the living Jesus. And always he was in the day-to-day miracle in my life as a struggling student with so many issues. It would have taken me 6 or 7 years to finish accounting because I did not do well in several accounting subjects during my junior and senior year in college because I literally majored in extracurricular activities. I did not concentrate on my studies. And I was really, like, studying for me, it was tough. I had a problem with memorizing. I don't like to study. I always want just to go play and hang out. And I do a lot of cramming when I was there. So you can imagine the stress, you know, especially that I know that my dad especially told me that if he finds out that I was drinking, I was already drinking at that time, but, you know, nobody knew because I was in a different city. Finally, I was drinking or smoking, especially if I'm taking marijuana, zero tolerance, he will ship me back to the Bolog. And that would be a shame, you know, to have happened in my life if ever they found out. So they didn't really know what was happening or what I did there. But somehow, in God's mercy and sovereignty, I finished accounting in 4 years and was among the 13 students who graduated out of 800 students who got in with me in the accounting program during our sophomore year. Because the accounting program is one of the most difficult programs in university, many of my then who got into the program with me switched to other courses after a year or after a semester, while others did not pass the 1 year screening, leaving 13 of us to proceed and graduate. And this was a big deal for me, and God's mercy for me because I was my family's golden boy. As I've shared earlier, my brothers were fooling around, so they had so much. Their hope was on me, and I was always now the favored one. They brag about me, you know, how diligent I was and all those kind of stuff, but they never knew what I was doing when I was in university. So the pressure is very, very, very heavy. I was their hope and I was expected to succeed, but they never knew, as I said, what I was involved in until 12 years after graduation. God was there, but I did not feel His presence in my life until September 8th of 1984 when a Canadian student missionary from Revelstoke shared the gospel with me, telling me that Jesus loved me. You know, in my family, we were never demonstrative or expressive about our love for each other. In fact, I was the first one among the 10 of us to have said, I love you, to our parents. And I was already, 25 years old. You know, so we never really say that. But just for this guy to say that God loved me and gave His life for me, and He has a wonderful plan for my life, that really impacted me. I was still struggling to find purpose in life. And though my cousin has shared about Jesus with me a couple years back, but I began to hear this time and understand the gospel, the good news, for the first time on that day. I realized that my biggest obstacle to having a meaningful life wasn't that I had not enough things or stuff in my life and didn't have the approval of men, but my biggest problem was my sin and the disapproval of the Almighty God. I realized the biggest obstacle to happiness was that ambitions and things and the deep need for affirmation were on the throne of my life instead of Jesus, who provided perfect righteousness for me. I realized what Augustine had expressed many, many years before in his confessions. Thou hast made us for thyself, O Lord, and our heart is restless until it finds rest in thee. Thou hast made us for thyself, O Lord, and our heart is restless until it finds rest in thee. My eyes were opened. I understood the gospel for the first time, and I responded. The Canadian missionary who shared the gospel with me read the invitation of Jesus in Revelation 3:20. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If any man hear my voice and open the door, I will come in to him and will sup with him and he with me. That invitation is not just for me, but it's for everyone. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. He's not going to open the door. He gives us the freedom and the will to open it. Stand at the door and knock. If any man hear my voice and open the door, I will come in to him and he will sup with me and he with me. I responded to his invitation to come into my life and be my Lord and Savior. I believe the gospel and I repented and turned from my sin and asked Jesus to be the captain of my life at 2 a.m., 2 in the morning, in my own room on September 8, 1984. When I made that decision, I felt a heavy load fell off my back. I never knew how much weight I had carried until I experienced the lightness of the grace and the love and the mercy of God in my life when I have received Him. I felt His cleansing power all throughout my body, like it was just vibrating when I received His forgiveness, and everything has changed. There was a clarity and brightness now in everything, everywhere. They were alive in meaning, so much so that I could no longer sleep and could not stop myself from jumping with joy in my room and thanking Jesus for saving me. Life was no longer empty and meaningless this time. I was still a driven person, still driven to succeed in life, but I was now driven for Christ more and driven to serve Him. And success now has a different meaning in my life. Success is no longer about myself, but how God can use it to bless others and to bring people to Him. Success is no longer for me, but for the glory and honor of the one who saved me. And since that day, I was involved in Christian ministries in campus and in the church. I moved to Canada in 1991 and continued to devote my time in service to the Lord while working in the secular field. The Christian life has never been easy. In fact, God did not promise me an easy life, but He promised to be with me, His presence, every step of the way, in season or out of season, in good times and in bad. I cannot deny the fact that it is life. It is difficult to be a Christian. The battle against the world, the flesh, and the devil is difficult for me. Yet as hard as it may be, as that may be, I still chose Jesus and continue to choose him every day of my life. Some say life is just a series of decisions. We make choices, we live and learn. Now I'm standing at the crossroad, and I must choose which way to turn. Down the one road lies all the world can offer, all its power, its wealth and fame. Down the other, just a man with nail scars in his hand, but there's mercy in his eyes and there is power in his name. I choose Jesus, I choose Jesus. Solitary doubt, I choose Jesus. Not for miracles, but for loving me. Not for Bethlehem, but for Calvary. Not for a day, but for eternity, I choose Jesus. In my life, I've sailed the sea of reason. I was captain of my soul. There was no need for a Savior. I could live life on my own. And I heard him speak the language of compassion, words of healing for broken lives. When they nailed him to a tree, his love included me. Now he's calling me to follow and to leave the past behind. I choose Jesus, I choose Jesus. Without a solitary doubt, I choose Jesus. Not for miracles, but for loving me. Not for Bethlehem, but for Calvary. Not for a day, but for eternity, I choose Jesus. I actually just decided this morning to sing that song. I was reading what I had written to share, or would like to share this morning, but I thought that basically sums up, you know, what happened that September 8th of 1984. I chose Jesus, and I always say that every day I need to choose Jesus, because we make decisions every day, and you choose Jesus, and life becomes very meaningful. And I understand now what it means, what that verse says, that those come to me, all those of you who are heavily laden, I will give you rest. When you choose Jesus, he will fulfill his promise, his promises to you. So just a few minutes, I just want to share with you what's happening in the Philippines. As I mentioned, I moved back there, and for the last 4 years, I'm staying in the slums along with my team to work with the urban poor in one of the squatters areas in Davao City. And fast forward, we decided middle of 2018, after, you know, that I won't say unfortunate situation that we had. We were trying to acquire this piece of property adjacent to our Hope House, and it fell through. And so I was discouraged for about 3 days, but I went back to the Lord and asked, like, what are you doing, Lord, and where are we taking us? And then we realized then, looking back, that that was his way of basically sparing us from the grief that we might experience going forward. So we decided, after we learned that 74% of the poor in the Philippines are in the rural areas, we decided that we should go to the countryside and work with the poor, because all these poor in the rural areas are expected to migrate to the cities to look for a better life for them and for their families. And I said, well, if you are already heavily invested, why don't we go there and do early intervention so that they won't have to come to the cities? And so we came up with a very holistic program called Hectares of Hope. This is basically a convergence of what we have been doing in the slums. We have our school. We used to have a farm, and we farmed for almost 2 years. Now we have our own test farm, so we're going to use farming as our main livelihood program. We're going to provide as well, in partnership, hopefully with the government, some housing for them. And we also want to build churches there, not using the conventional church planting where you have to look for a place, build a church, and then look for a pastor. So everything that happens in these Hectares of Hope basically is reproducible. That's why we wanted everything to be something that people can take on, and they can just let it grow and go with it so that we can help other communities as well. So I'm going to show you just, this is just some slides, just to let you understand what we are actually praying for, what we are aspiring to do. So, Hope the Nations. How do I do this? Wait. Okay. Wow, can you see that? That's a member of my team. We have some volunteers, but these are the ones that are receiving allowance or are receiving salary. Anyway, I will. So, you could see that one in five, and this is a 2015 census, and one in five in the people in the Philippines are poor. So it's about 22%, you know, 22 million basically. But I don't really agree with this number, just because we have, the reason why it's lower than what we are actually, what we know is the real number, is because the government is giving financial assistance to impoverished families who have children in elementary school. So each child up to three receives 300 pesos, which is $6 US, and each family that have those children also get 500 pesos, which is $10 every month. And so because of this stimulus, the people who are in this program, they call it For Peace, have now the ability to purchase and have some little disposable income, so to speak. And that basically affected the numbers. So without that stimulus, we would probably be in the high 20s or even more than 30s. There was a report from the UNICEF that 50% of the Filipinos feel that they are poor. So that means in our context, when you feel that you're poor, you're basically living a day at a time. No savings, no insurance, so it's like what we call a scratch and eat. So that's the reality in the Philippines. And we want to really impact community, the rural poor and those who will be relocated from the urban areas. We want to help them and have this through this project called Hectares of Hope. It's going to be a pilot project for 2 years. And I'll just skip that one. in the rural areas, that's, you know, it's very average. You could see some of those housing. They're basically easily flattened by strong wind, you know. And most of these people are landless. You know, they're just basically having a squatting on somebody else's land. Most of the lands in the rural areas have been, people have been buying, or they have been taken away from the farmers immorally, or, you know, so it's a really sad situation. So we want to be able. So why the rural poor? It's just because they don't have opportunities there for livelihood to earn some income. There's no access to basic services like health and education. And even some child protection programs from the government, and all of these, you know, we have a very substandard education. I'm not embarrassed to share that, but because we have so many students in the school system, the average number of students in one classroom in elementary and even in a junior high and senior high is between 65 and 75. So it ranges. Sometimes their classes are 90. When we started this feeding program, we had a pilot feeding program that we did. It's a school-based. That's where I saw in three schools that we have been working in. They have very small rooms, cramped, really no place for the kids to even walk inside the room. And the teachers are so depleted because they have morning sessions and evening sessions, or afternoon sessions. The morning session starts from 6 and it ends at 11:30, and then the next batch will come in at 12 and goes to up to 6. So one teacher, two basically classes every day, and have to teach a lot of these subjects. So you can imagine the quality of education. So the ones that have money are able to go to private school, or they will homeschool their kids so that they can they have a better education. So we have a school now. It's called Pathway to Life Schoolhouse, and it's a leadership academy. We're very, very astute about academics. We believe, just by comparison, that we are providing a better quality of education compared to the private schools. We have the three core, we call it the theme magnets: leadership, values, and spiritual formation. So everything that we do has to be in the context of leadership and spiritual formation. And so we're in the process of getting accredited with the Department of Education, but they won't accredit us unless we have the space. And in the squatters, our area, we don't even have our driveway, which is like smaller compared to the driveway here. That's basically our grounds. So we would not qualify. And that is one of the reasons that we will move to the rural areas. And so those are just, you know, some of the reasons, major reasons why. Okay. So now this is a rendering. My alma mater, Sinimang University, university I went to, their architectural engineering department has kind of verbally agreed and partnered with us by providing us some rendering of the. This is very conceptual. We basically send them our concept, our vision of what this community is all about. And they came up with this rendering. And the reason, one of the things that we want to make sure is that we will not be giving social housing to these poor people. The reason why is that the poor have always received substandard housing and help. And we want to be able to raise the sense of dignity. That's why we want to come up with a subdivision for the poor. We want them to have better houses. The way we look at it is like, if this is our own family, we would do everything we can to be able to give them an environment where they can grow and flourish and also be on their own feet and be empowered. So even in a mindset, we want to change the mindset from a poverty mentality to of empowerment. And even in our messaging, we don't call them recipients or beneficiaries, we call them partners, because they have to partner with us to make this all work. And so, long story short, I have some preliminary discussions with government agencies, the housing program. When I go back there, I will be right away working and going to the mayor's office to get them to buy the land that we need to do this. The government, the city is actually looking for 232 hectares. That's like 2.5 acres per hectare to put the marginalized, the poor and those who are relocated from the urban areas to give them housing there. So we want to align in that program. And so we need, for this pilot project, we need 5 hectares. And farming is our main technology, but we will also have some ancillary businesses, some cottage industries that we will establish to give them even more opportunities to earn an income. We have looked at our economics. By the way, Scott Louie, you know him. He and I are tied to the hip for this. So we work together. We make decisions together along with the team anyway. So he's very as much involved as I am. But so we have been looking, he and I have been looking at the economics and came out very conservative estimates. And we, you know, by faith, our vision is to get this poor out of poverty in 10 months. So it's very, very ambitious, 10 to 12 months. It's an ambitious undertaking, but we believe in a big God. But we look at, since we have already done some test farming, and we could see that they are capable of earning above the threshold of poverty, which is the 10,000, they can earn up to 22,000 if they are also involved in some of these cottage industries. So we're very excited about that, and even more because everything is fluid. We're working, and everybody will be working. There's a school there, and that's when we also want to work with them in terms of building his church. And I have partnered with an organization called missions organization called Followers Movement, and they use storytelling. This is really intended for the poor who are not educated, and especially the Ms, the Muslims, and those who are in, because we have a lot of tribes there, indigenous people. So we use storytelling as the medium of sharing the gospel and sharing the story of God. And so they're very heavy in obedience and also heavy in discipleship. So we've already gone through training once, and then we will again do this coming, actually when I go back there, we'll start again. So we're very excited about that because we see the impact already of that program, you know, with my staff, and it's very easy to do. You know, you don't need to have a pastor to come and teach, but they can share the stories and ask questions, where is God in the story? How do you see yourself in the story? And what is God asking you to do? So we are very heavy, especially in obedience, because we want now to put some structure, not only in financial or domestic environment of these people, but even in their spiritual lives as well. So I'm running out of time, but thank you for your support. Please pray for me. I need prayer, especially my health. I'm starting to feel my arthritis now, shoulders and my knees and my toes. So I hope to be able to get some medication when I go back. It's very expensive, but I'm trusting God that He will sustain me. But pray for my team as well. We are very excited, very lean right now. Our skill sets are complementary, and so we're ready to go. Praise God for, there was a Singaporean who has already paid 1 year's rent for us. Well, actually 70% of our rent for 1 year. So we're very happy. So we're moving into this new place. As we're speaking, they're actually moving already to our new location. So we're very excited. I'm counting the hours now. Just going back to the Philippines is very exciting for me. Okay, thank you. And if you have any questions, you can always approach me after. God bless.